It is my great pleasure, my great privilege to introduce my good friend, Nick the Devil. Dr. Nicholas Sutton. Nick has got his PhD from Lancaster University, a very good stable. That's a normal expression, isn't it? Perfectly acceptable. He teaches at various universities throughout the UK. He is director of the Continuing Education Department at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies. Has developed that department wonderfully. His curriculum we're working on at the moment our desire is to publish it because it's really so good. You know, every module, there are 15 modules now, and there are 100 pages at least of notes per module. All excellent stuff, very good introduction material. But apart from that, which is something he really likes to work on, he has also published his PhD, which is Religious Doctrines of the Mahabharata, which is, for anyone who's read it, is a really excellent perspective on the Mahabharata. And has been very, very useful to a lot of students at the centre we know. And he is here today to talk about... Oh, God, I'm another one of those ones. He's going to talk about something. And he's a brilliant talker, I can tell you. Educational perspectives from the Mahabharata, interestingly enough. Okay. And he's very good. Let's listen to him and then question him thoroughly.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. My original brief for speaking here was indeed education in the Mahabharata, or education from the Mahabharata. But I'm hoping that I can maybe, having listened to earlier presentations and chatted with a few people over the last two or three days, maybe broaden the scope of that to consider preaching and education and also perhaps the work that we have with the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies, which I think provides us with a really interesting model of what preaching can be, which is perhaps a little bit, and education can be, which is perhaps a little bit different from what we would normally understand preaching to be. But the main part of what I'm going to talk about is indeed the Mahabharata. And I think, first of all, we perhaps need to... I'll say a little bit about the structure of the Mahabharata and a little bit about the way that academic studies of the Mahabharata have gone. I'm sure many of you are familiar, at least, with the central themes of the Mahabharata. Mahabharata studies received a boost, a fillip, in the late 1960s. Prior to that, they'd gone into something of a state of abeyance. And the boost that they received was due to the presentation, the complete presentation of a critical edition of the Sanskrit text. The Mahabharata itself is an enormous work. Professor Van Buitenen described it as dismally intractable before he died, having attempted to translate it. And since that time, there has been no complete English translation of the work existing. And in fact, the only English translation available to us is the one produced in the 1880s, I think, by Ganguly. And if anyone's tried to work with that, there are difficulties because it's not of the critical edition, and therefore you can often find fascinating material in Ganguly's translation which isn't in the Sanskrit text, which can be a little frustrating. But when the critical edition came as a result of 30 years of work from mainly Indian scholars under the leadership of V.S. Suttankar, it aroused a wave of interest, and today there are conferences held on the Mahabharata. I've attended a few of those myself. In fact, the last conference I ever attended was before this one was a Mahabharata conference in SOAS, which was interrupted sadly by the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, who put in an uninvited appearance by blowing up the tube and the buses. They nearly got me, actually. I don't think it was personal. So anyway, at that conference, it struck me, listening to the papers and also the publication of that, the way that the Mahabharata was understood from an academic perspective is to look at it as an epic work, to try and link it into the European myth, Dumézil's idea, or perhaps from the French scholarship, Viarga and others, looking perhaps to find almost a subtext beneath the overt text. What is it saying beneath it? Look for the significance of the names as almost like a hidden myth underneath what the text is actually saying. And there's a number of fascinating works come out along those, many disagreeing with one another. British scholarship or European scholarship has tended to work from a text critical perspective on the Mahabharata and try and establish layers of text from different chronological eras. So the orthodox view today still is that the Mahabharata as we have it today in the critical edition was composed not by one author at one time, but perhaps over a period as long as 500 or 600 years, with different sections of material being added. So there are a number of papers at the conference being given on that, but most of them were looking to unpick the hidden meanings, what's going on behind the text, which has made it very interesting conference and makes ethics studies reasonably interesting. However, there's a couple of misgivings I had about the whole conference. Firstly, there were no Hindus there. There were no Indians. Oh, Ramila Thapa was there and Professor Rukmani was there. But apart from that, there was no Hindu input at all from it. And it also, the second misgiving I had, which I think raised in my mind all sorts of questions about ownership and also imperialism, almost as if, here we are again, the white folk telling the Indians what they didn't really know. We've come along and we've explained it for you. You've had it for a few thousand years, but you've never properly understood, so if you can sit there at the back quietly, we'll tell you where it's at, which I felt uncomfortable with. There isn't much listening going on, and also there isn't a recognition of the ownership of the text, which I always feel belongs to the community who believes in it and reveres it and has preserved it over generations. Secondly, I'm not entirely happy, not at all happy actually, with the understanding of the Mahabharata as an epic work. In part, most of the form critical presentations are inconclusive and contradictory, to the extent now where just a few years ago our filter Bible from the University of Chicago produced a book on the Mahabharata, in which he just dismissed all the previous orthodoxy about layers, chronological layers of text, and said, no, it was all composed at one time by a single author, or something like that. So it's inconclusive. You end up thinking, well, that's an interesting language, but you don't end up knowing anything. Also, it raises the question, what is the Mahabharata? And from my point of view, always, the Mahabharata is a sacred text. It's a work of religious literature that exists within a number of different communities and provides a form of religious, moral, ethical guidance to that community. And I don't think enough justice is done to the Mahabharata as sacred text and its role as sacred text. And I suppose that's linked to the fact that there were no Hindus present at the conference. I don't know if they've been not invited, but anyway, they weren't there. And I think so. From my point of view, there's a whole area of Mahabharata studies which are ignored, which is its function as sacred text and what is it teaching, what is it saying, and perhaps what I'm going to talk about more importantly is how is it saying it, how does it propose to teach. If we look, I'll say a little bit about the structure of the Mahabharata, as we have it. I know many of you will be familiar with the main stories. There is, as you probably know, a huge narrative, epic narrative, that runs almost throughout the entire text, beginning from the birth of the Pandavas, the quarrel with the Kauravas, the second book, the Sabhaparvan, the gambling match, and the Vanaparvan, in which the Pandavas wander through the forest, Subhaparvan, in which the Udyoga Parvan, in which the preparations for war are made, and then the extensive accounts of warfare and battle where he kills him and he kills the other and this person kills that man and he kills so many others were killed on this day, which run through several books of the Mahabharata: Bhishma Parvan, Drona Parvan, Karna Parvan and Shalya Parvan, concluding with the death of Duryodhan and then the Sautika Parvan, in which all the survivors are pretty much rubbed out, and then the Stree Parvan, in which the women lament for their dead loved ones. And that pretty much brings the story to an end. That's the 11th book. But then beyond the 11th book, beyond the Stree Parvan, we have the Shanti Parvan and the Anushasana Parvan and the Ashvamedika Parvan, which are filled almost entirely with what we might call a didactus, didactic passages. They don't carry the narrative further at all. It's merely a series of questions and answers on a vast range of topics relating to all manner of religious and secular ideas. And the main questioner there is Yudhishthira, and the main speaker there is Bhishma. Again, you may recall that Bhishma is wounded very badly in the course of the battle by Arjuna, shoots huge number of arrows through his body so that he's laid down on the battlefield, but he doesn't die because he has the benediction that he waits to the Uttarayana cycle, auspicious time. So he's lying on the battle splayed out, and the others have perhaps a little unreasonably come up and spend a few days questioning him about all manner of subjects. And this it covers a vast, must cover 500-600 chapters before finally the sun moves and he goes. And within this, and Shirley was saying, when we do our continuing education courses, if there's any topic that comes up, like recently we were doing the reverence for the cow, vegetarianism, Shraddha rites, any sort of moral issues at all, dowry, marriage, etc., the Mahabharata is an ideal place to look, because as it says itself, everything that exists is contained here. Whatever's not here does not exist, it says, which is an exaggeration. But nonetheless, it's the first port of call if you want to find out any Hindu textual teaching on a particular subject. The Mahabharata is a place to look. So it goes on for 500, 600 chapters before the final, it goes back to the narrative with the winding up when the Pandavas have performed their yajna, and then they go up to the mountains and then are elevated to heaven, so that the narrative itself ends in the domain of the gods. So how does it function then? I would say it teaches in a number of different ways. First of all, the narrative itself is an instructional narrative. The way that people do things, the characterization of different individuals is also didactic in that sense. On one extreme we have Yudhishthira, perhaps, who is the exemplar of dharma, and we have at the other end, as Van Buyten says, his dark antithesis, Duryodhan, who is the exemplar of adharma. Although, again, demonstrating the problematic nature of the text, Jim Fitzgerald has published a number of pieces in which he says he regards Yudhishthira as the villain of the Mahabharata, and the whole text is designed to show how useless kings like Yudhishthira were, modelled perhaps on Ashok, the non-violent king, and how it all ends in tears if you do that. But I think I would still say that the exemplar of dharma is Yudhishthira. And then we've got Duryodhan, but Duryodhan's not a silent villain. Duryodhan also has his point of view, and at various times he'll come to the fore and he'll set forth his perspective on life, on dharma and virtue, which is very interesting. In fact, it sounds a lot like Margaret Thatcher to me. He emphasises always, he always emphasises rugged individualism and competition, and it's good to have enemies because it brings out the very best in you, and that's why I understand dharma, and that's why I have enemies. So he has it, and it's there in the Mahabharata. It's there, and I could quote the verses and say this is what the Mahabharata says, but we know, because it's Duryodhan, we know that whatever Duryodhan says is self-evidently nonsense. It's wrong because it's put into his mouth. But nonetheless, it does make one pause and think a little bit. So the characterization, the structure of the narrative teaches a lesson. And then, of course, we have the debates that take place. For example, in the Udyoga part of them, the Book of Preparation, there are intense debates between the main characters over what action they should take. They've been mistreated, they've been abused, they've been cheated and they've been robbed. Therefore, does that make action of a violent nature justifiable? Some say yes, some say no, others say we should just tolerate. And so the debates go back and forward. And it's not just that the bad characters are saying one thing and the good characters are saying another, so you know where you stand. The good characters disagree very radically with one another. Yudhishthira says one thing, Draupadi says something completely different. Draupadi has a go at him. She says she uses some quite harsh words against her husband. So he's a fool, an idiot, and not worthy of kingship at some point. So the good characters disagree as well in their debates. And then finally, we have overtly didactic passages such as those spoken by Bhishma, in which he gives these vast array of instructions to Yudhishthira and the assembled Pandavas there. So it is, in a variety of different ways, it is a teaching text. It is designed to give teaching. And what are the teachings about? And as I've suggested, the teachings of the Mahabharata cover a huge range of subject areas, but at the risk of oversimplifying, I would say that it functions in three primary ways. First of all, and perhaps primarily, it is a dharma shastra, in the sense that it debates, it looks at what is dharma, how are we to understand what dharma is, and it looks at different opinions. And repeatedly the phrase reoccurs, dharma hub sukshmosti, that dharma is subtle. It's very difficult to say exactly what dharma is, enormous different number of perspectives on that, which I'll come back to in a minute. So, and I would say that the narrative portion of the Mahabharata is almost entirely a dharma shastra. Its overwhelming preoccupation is virtue, what is dharma, doing the right thing. Perhaps secondarily, it's also a bhakti shastra, because within the Mahabharata we have Krishna as one of the major characters, and despite what you sometimes read in the literature, it's not just in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna is revealed as a divine person, an avatar or a descent, a manifestation of Narayana. That is made apparent repeatedly in passages throughout the Mahabharata, that Krishna is not one of the ordinary warriors there. He is actually a divine being, and he is controlling everything that takes place. So in that sense, there is a representation of divinity and an understanding of divine action within the world. And in that sense, the Mahabharata, including and if you like excluding the Gita, is also a bhakti shastra. And moreover, in the didactic passages that Bhishma and others speak in towards the end, there are quite extensive teachings on the nature of Vaishnavism. In fact, there's the Naranarayaniya Parvam that we were discussing a little while ago, which is an early expression of Pancharatrika Vaishnavism, although the question of how closely it relates to the Pancharatra we were talking about the other day is very questionable, but it names itself as being Pancharatric. And however, and perhaps paradoxically, also within the Mahabharata, we have some fairly extensive passages of Shaivism as well, in which Shiva is represented as being the supreme deity. So if it's a bhakti shastra, it's a Vaishnava bhakti shastra, and it's also a Shaivite at times bhakti shastra. And then finally, it's a moksha shastra as well. I would say again that the narrative itself of Yudhishthira, Arjuna, Bhim, Nakul and Sahadeva isn't at all concerned with moksha. And that's represented at the end where the characters, Arjuna, although he's heard the Bhagavad Gita, he says he's understood it, Nashto Moha, Smritir Labdha, he doesn't gain moksha. He's up in heaven. In fact, he's in hell. First of all, but he's ultimately in heaven. He's attained the level of Svargaloka, and we know from the Gita that Svargaloka isn't moksha, because kshine punye martya lokam vishanti, when your punya is exhausted you come back to the world of death. So I think it's slightly puzzling at times, why would Arjuna, the hearer of the Gita, and Krishna says bhakti simi sakachiti, you're my friend and my devotee, why isn't he getting moksha? Why is he having to accept the secondary blessing, if you like, of being in Svargaloka? And the answer is because at that point, in that part of the Mahabharata is functioning as a Dharma Shastra, not as a Moksha Shastra. But within Bhishma's teachings, there is the emphasis is switched in a certain section of his teachings from Dharma towards Moksha. And that again makes the Mahabharata such an important text in the development of Indian religious thought, because it's within the Mahabharata, particularly Book 12, the Shanti Paravan, and Book 14, the Ashvamedika Paravan, that we find, as far as I'm aware, the earliest, almost the earliest extant teachings on Sankhya and Yoga, which certainly predate Patanjali and, of course, Ishwakrishna's Sankhya Karika as well. So the earliest passage, and I'm aware of the Upanishadic passages, Svetashvatara and Katha, but these are very brief references. The earliest systematic presentation of the yoga system is to be found in passages like the Yoga Kutanam in the Mahabharata, and these are, I think, not given due prominence in the study of these traditions, but they are very, very important passages which make it very clear that the goal of Sankhya, the goal of yoga, is the achievement of a moksha, liberation from rebirth. So, three things: Dharma Shastra, Moksha Shastra, Bhakti Shastra, etc. Okay, that's a brief summation, perhaps, of what it does teach and why I think the Mahabharata is such an important text in the development of Indian religious thought. I mean, some people might ask, I did mention dating, where does the Mahabharata come in dating? And as Patrick Oliver explained so eloquently, dating is almost impossibly difficult within the Indian religious tradition. There are very few solid factors, but for what it's worth, we can attach a date to. But for what it's worth, the orthodox academic view is that the Mahabharata was compiled probably between 300 BC and perhaps the latest sections 300 AD. Although, as I've mentioned, Alf Hilfebeckel has recently dissented from that view, and I wouldn't put any particular weight on it, but that's what most people say. I think the point would be that it's certainly probably later than the major Upanishads, and almost certainly earlier than the Puranic material. So it stands at a crucial juncture between two forms, the Vedic Hinduism of the earlier period, and perhaps the forms of Hinduism more influenced by Tantra at a later period. I think perhaps then what I want to move on to quite rapidly actually before is not so much what it talks about, but the way that it teaches. And I think it, within this we can then look at a model of sacred text which is perhaps novel, original, and perhaps unfamiliar to those of us from a Western background, because certainly those brought up in the farther ends of the Protestant tradition, and perhaps those schooled in the Islamic tradition, will have a notion of sacred text primarily as authority. It tells us the way things are, and it tells us the way that we should conduct ourselves in response to that. It is an authority. And it's, in many cases, in religion, it's an unquestioned authority. Something is right because the text says it to be so. Because the text makes the proclamation, therefore that becomes unchallengeable. And we're seeing now in Britain, perhaps other places as well, the terrible debates, the divisions within the Church of England over questions of the ordination of women and homosexuality. And textual quotations are given, which are deemed to be, by many from the evangelical wings, to be virtually unchallengeable. If it says so in the text, then the argument ends. And that's one approach to sacred text, the idea that sacred text is above us, teaching down to us. It is a revelation from a higher domain. Those in the realm of the spirit have passed down their message to us who are in the lower realm, and because they are higher than us, they have an authoritative status, and we must therefore accept what they say, perhaps with some questioning, but ultimately the authority remains. If we come to apply that to a text like the Mahabharata, then it's instantaneously problematic. It just really doesn't work. Partly because the teachings are so diverse and there are different perspectives presented in different points of the text. Like I mentioned already the question of Arjuna. Why does Arjuna only get to Svargaloka? Because it's a Dharma Shastra there rather than a Bhakti Shastra at that point. So the diversity, the variegatedness of the teachings makes it problematical, because at certain points different lines of teaching don't fit together very evenly, like one of those bad jigsaws you used to get for Christmas where the pieces don't properly fit in together. It's hard to kind of collate the teachings of the Mahabharata into a unified system. So that's one point. Secondarily, though, and again more importantly, I don't think the Mahabharata itself, as a didactic text, aims to teach in that way. It doesn't aim to be our sovereign master at all. And in fact, in many ways, I find reading it carefully, it teases you, it plays with you, it shows you one thing until you think you know exactly what it's saying, and then it shows you the opposite. And it reminds me in some ways, I don't know if anybody's read any of these, of Plato's representations of Socrates' teaching. I'm not that experienced in them, but when I read them, it seems that you can pick out Socrates never actually says anything. He just asks questions. What do you think about this? And then when somebody says, well, I think it's, he says, yeah, but that could be wrong, or that could be wrong. And he just sort of moves people along without ever actually coming down definitely and saying this is right or this is wrong. And it strikes me that the Mahabharata works in a very similar way. It deliberately shows you one thing. And he says, look at this, see how you think about this, and you read it and you think, yes, that's exactly right. And then you move along in the narrative and it shows you another thing. Well, but what about this? How does this work? And for example, and I'll give a number of examples how I see it working in that way. I think one of the character of Yudhishthira himself exemplifies that. I've mentioned earlier Jim Fitzgerald's thesis that Yudhishthira is the villain of the Mahabharata. Personally, I think that's completely untenable, because there are so many passages of the Mahabharata where Yudhishthira is shown to be the paragon of virtue. He is the Dharma Raj. He is Dharma. He is the embodiment of Dharma. When it's the answers from the serpent Nahush, who's captured all the Pandavas, when it's the Yaksha who's caused all the Pandavas to be poisoned, it's always Yudhishthira who comes forward and has all the answers to Dharma. His behaviour is always renounced. It's devoid of anger, greed, aggression, etc. He is a perfect human being in many ways, and this is shown in the stories. There's the story, perhaps, you know, of when Jayadrath comes and he tries to seize Draupadi, and Arjuna and Bhima set off and capture him, and they drag him back, and Bhima's all ready to snuff him out, basically. But Yudhishthira comes forward and he says, no, think, this man has a wife, he has children, think what will happen. And the Bhima says, he deserves death for this outrage. But Yudhishthira says, no, think of the others who will suffer if you do that. Let's return him to the kingdom. We can't take that action. Another example, after the battle is over, Dhritarashtra, the blind king, is still alive. And it turns out Bhima sometimes goes around and whispers in his ear when no one's looking, I killed Duryodhan. And he sometimes goes to him just to show the thigh that he broke. He sort of mocks him. And there comes a point where Dhritarashtra wants to perform the Shraddha, the rites for his departed sons who've been killed in the battle. And Bhima says, no, don't give him a penny for that. Let's have all his sons rot in hell. Don't do any rites for them. But Yudhishthira says, no, he's our uncle. He's an object of respect. And he goes and he bows before him and says, uncle, you're my master. Whatever I have is yours. Please take as much as you want to perform the rites. So, intensely forgiving. And when I read those passages, I think, what a wonderful person he is, despite all the indignities that have been done to him, in which Dhritarashtra was complicit, he's still got that enormous power of forgiveness. So you read that and you think, yes, this is Yudhishthira, perfect Dharma. But then you come along to another passage, and then you see they're in with Virata, in the realm of Virata, and Draupadi then is being molested by this roughneck Kichok, who's the commander of the army, and it's getting to the point where he's almost getting to the stage of rape with Draupadi, and Draupadi is complaining to her husband. And Yudhishthira, when she comes to him, he gives her a lecture on tolerance, the power of destiny, and how you must forbear and we have to accept our fate, which doesn't seem particularly appropriate given the circumstances. So then she goes to Bhima and makes the same complaint, and Bhima has a different response where he goes and gives him a few slaps, basically, and kills him, batters him into a ball of flesh. And then he's... but you sort of tend to think, well, maybe that was what the guy needed. Because there was no way that... He was an out-and-out molester, and he needed vigorous action, perhaps not being battered into a ball of flesh, that was perhaps going a bit too far, but he needed some vigorous action. I think the point that the text is making is there are times, yeah, Yudhishthira is a great man, but he's also a king, and there are times when you need a king, not just to speculate about virtue, tolerance, destiny, etc., but to take vigorous action. And when we're talking about this with the Hindus, I always give the example, if your house is being broken into by a burglar armed with a metal bar, and you phone the police, who do you want to get on the end of the line? PC Yudhishthira or PC Bhima? Well, obviously you want Bhima to come. You don't want Yudhishthira to come round in a squad car and give him a lecture on virtue. You want Bhima to come round and get a hold of him and sort him out. So I think the text plays in that way. So, oh yeah, Yudhishthira is great. He's a fine man. He's a wonderful person. But put him in this situation and it just doesn't work. It's not that simple. Similarly in the battle, he doesn't do battles very well. He doesn't do gambling very well. It's not suitable for him. So when he gets in the gambling situation, again, he just goes to pieces. He gambles everything he's ever had and things that he's never had as well away. Similarly in the battle, when he's faced with Karna, Karna shoots him through with arrows, and he just loses control, and he rails against Arjuna, says, "You're useless, you've left me alone." And he speaks very... unkindly and unfairly to Arjuna. You can see again that he's a man who shouldn't be in that position. So I think what the text is doing again is saying, yes, here's Yudhishthira, don't you admire him? Look at this that he does, look at that what he does, look at that. And you think, yeah, exactly, yeah, Yudhishthira, Dharmaraja. And he says, yeah, but look at this. Doesn't work, does it? And it never really answers the question. It shows you the pages, it shows you the vignettes of the action, but it ultimately doesn't draw the conclusion together. Another example would be at the end of the, right at the very end in the Svargarohana Parvam, book 18, you know the story again, Yudhishthira, he's walking up, he's the last one, and the chariot comes down from heaven to take him up, and somehow Yudhishthira's picked up a dog along the way, and the charioteer, I think it's Daruka, says to him, come on, time to go, because you've been perfect, you've never done a sinful action in your life. Well, not quite, never done a sinful action. So come along. And Yudhishthira said, no, I'm not going in without my dog. And apparently there's no dogs allowed in heaven, so he can't go. He says, unless I take my dog, I'm not going. But then the dog is revealed as Dharma, and it's the final test. So Yudhishthira is elevated to heaven, and when he gets there, he passes through, and he sees his brothers in hell, but we'll come back to that in a minute. And he sees Duryodhan, Shakuni, even Dushasan. And I was talking about this to a group of our students there, and they wouldn't believe that. They made me get the Sanskrit text down and point out the names Dushasan and Shakuni. There was a sense of outrage. Why are these fellows in heaven? And the same, Yudhishthira shares that as well. Narada is his guide to heaven. And Yudhishthira stops us. What are these fellows doing here? They were the most wicked, worthless, unrighteous, brutal, cruel. They didn't have a single good quality to rub between them. And yet here they are sitting in elevated seats in heaven. And Narada says, yes, but you know the rule. As Krishna says, Vigita Hatova Prakshasi Svargam. If you die in battle, you attain heaven. So although they were morally worthless, they fulfilled their Kshatriya Dharma to its bitter end. They died facing the enemy, and they deserve their place in heaven. But Yudhishthira doesn't say, oh, thank you, Naraji, for telling me, or setting me right about this. He says, no, that's rubbish. He says, I'm not having that. I don't even want to stay here with these people. Get me out of here. I don't know. And that's where virtually the Mahabharata ends. You're never told, in this way, Narada showed Yudhishthira the truth, or in this way, Yudhishthira showed Narada the truth. The matter is left open, and the reader is shown the options, is shown the problems, is shown the questions that are being asked, but is left to draw his or her own conclusions. And there are a number of issues like that. I'll mention one or two. I think some of the ones that are perhaps most interesting. We know again from the Bhagavad Gita, one of Krishna's main themes that he takes up, main ideas within the Gita, is that of karma yoga, the idea of desireless action. You know, that you can remain active in the world, perform your dharmic duty, but at the same time, if you become attached emotionally and mentally, then you are pursuing the path of moksha. In that way, he reconciles dharma and the pursuit of moksha through the idea of a karma yoga. And he says overtly, he says, I mean, chapter 3 of the Gita, karma naiva hisansidim ashtita janakadeha, that kings like Janaka and others achieved sansidim, perfection, karma naiva, through karmana eva, just by performing their religious dharmic duty. That's Krishna's proclamation, that karma yoga is a path to perfection. Fine. Now, if we look ahead to another passage later on in the Mahabharata, we've got a passage called the Sulabha-Janak Samvad, in which the same King Janak that Krishna mentions as having achieved perfection through performing his karma yoga is shown to be in a conversation with a female sannyasi called Sulabha. And she basically... she just gives him a telling off for the whole thing and says he doesn't really know very much. Because when he comes up, when she appears there, she says to her something like, he says, one word of it is kuzya, which is an interrogative. It means, whose are you? Who do you belong to? In other words, what are you doing? You're an independent woman. You've broken all the principles. And then she says, because you see me as a woman and not as a, not in a spiritual level, therefore I judge you to be just a little bit advanced. And then he makes the point, said, well, you've got the Tridandi and you're a sannyasi, but I'm the same, you know, I've just got my crown and my throne and we're doing the same thing, aren't we? You know, we've both got our own paraphernalia. He says, no, that's rubbish. You can't do that. You can't do this karma yoga thing, because isn't it the case when you're making a war, you've got to think, he's my friend, he's my enemy, I'll do this, I'll gain this, and that, and the other. He said, basically, if you're in that situation of emotional turmoil and conflict with friends, enemies, you've got to make judgments that are based on materialistic considerations. So he said, this karma yoga idea, I don't buy it at all. And yet we've had it earlier in the Gita from Krishna. He said, yes, karmanaiva hi sansidhim ashtita janakadayaha, that you achieve, and then you've got later on Sulabha, another authoritative voice, rubbishing that very same idea. And that's just, and again, I've already mentioned it in terms of the Bhakti Shastra, the fact that that most of the narrative and certain parts of the didactic portion of the text are Vaishnava in orientation. They refer to the usual avatar story, the descent, and avatars are named. Again, another reason why the Mahabharata is so important. It's the first text that we have which actually refers to a doctrine of avatar. So primarily it is Vaishnava, and there are passages of Vaishnava teaching in which Krishna is proclaimed to be Narayan, and Narayan is represented as the supreme truth, the creator and controller of all things, including of course the Bhagavad Gita. But then later on in the text we'll find, I can't remember what it's called now, it's the beginning of book 13, an extensive passage of Shaivite teachings which take a completely different perspective, in which Krishna is represented as being a devotee of Shiva, as being a Shaivite and being initiated by Upamanyu into the Shaivite tradition. Shaivite, Upamanyu is well known from Puranic sources as a great Shaivite teacher. And then the passage shows how Krishna worships Shiva and how Shiva is shown to be the supreme deity in exactly the same way that Vishnu was earlier. So even within the Bhakti teachings, it can be Vaishnava or it can be Shaivite. And again, no debate is taken on this, really. No, there's never any point said, yes, but wait a minute, you said Vishnu was supreme. You're just left with those passages. Here you are, this is about Vishnu. Here you are, this is about Shiva. And then the text walks away and leaves you to get on with it. And finally, one of my favourites is in the battle, we have numerous teachings in which it states that dharma is truth, truth is dharma. I can't remember where it is now. There's a passage in there's a eulogy of truth. Truth is satya, is all the Vedas. Satya is dharma, satya is moksha. It's almost like kind of a satyam gita, if you like, a eulogy of satyam. And then we have another passage later on. This is in the Karmakarban, where Yudhishthira is kind of lost a bit. As I said before, he's shot through with arrows, he's wounded, he's hurt, he's humiliated because Karna has beaten him, and he's also let him off with mocked him after he's defeated him. Arjuna was somewhere else fighting, holding the army together. When Arjuna comes back, Yudhishthira condemns him, and he says, "Your bow, Gandiv, is useless, utterly useless. Why do you even bother carrying it?" And then Arjuna says, "Ah, that's a problem, because I've taken a solemn oath that anybody who criticizes my bow, Gandiv, will have to be killed. I'm going to have to kill you now." So he's drawing his sword out, and he says, "Sorry, you're my brother, but I have taken a solemn vow, and I never speak a word that's untruth, therefore I'm going to have to kill you." At that point, fortunately, Krishna intervenes and says, "Stop, stop, you don't understand what dharma is." And he tells a story then about a sadhu called Kaushika who had taken a vow of perpetual truthfulness. And the story runs, as Krishna tells it, that some robbers came to the village nearby. The villagers ran off to hide in a cave with their possessions. The robbers asked the sage Kaushik, "Where are the villagers hiding?" And Kaushik said, "They're hiding in that cave over there with all their possessions." And so the robbers went and killed them all. And then Krishna says, "In that case, truth was adharma and lying was dharma." He says then, you can't reduce dharma to a set of codes of what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Even though later on the Mahabharata has such codes. It contains all the rules of dowry, marriage, inheritance, etc. Krishna says, you can't do that. You can't reduce. Dharma is, he said, "I define dharma as that which brings good, the welfare of all living beings. Having understood that truth, you must now act as you see fit," he says. And then Arjuna then tweaks that his whole conception of dharma is completely, was wrong, because he had this formulaic assumption about dharma. The rule is always speak the truth, and therefore, even though it seems ridiculous, I've got to follow that particular formula. But again, the Mahabharata doesn't give us any definitive final answer on this. It merely comes to the, it shows you the different options and leaves you ultimately to make up your own mind. And I think, how are we to respond to that? I mean, some might say this is because the Mahabharata is it's a combined text. It's not a single unitary work. It's been put together by different people at different times, and therefore it has no final, definitive, last answer as a voice. But I don't. Having read it, I've read it. One of the few people alive who've read the Mahabharata twice and lived to tell the tale. But I don't see doing that. I see it's overtly offering different options. It is. It's not seeing itself in that way that I outlined earlier as being an absolutely authoritative text before whom the reader is obliged to grovel. It's rather than being a master. The Mahabharata in the religious life of the follower, the Mahabharata functions as a servant. The text is the servant of the aspirant and not the master of the aspirant. It is a spiritual resource that is provided for each and every individual to use in their own way. And perhaps not at all. You might read the Mahabharata and think, that's nothing for me at all. Which is fine, just set it aside and move on. Or you might find specific passages that are particularly relevant for what you're thinking about at this particular time. I find that myself, frequently. Things, issues, ideas that you've been thinking about, running around in your head whilst you're driving your car or something like that. And suddenly you read a passage in the Mahabharata and you think, that gives an insight into that particular issue. And that, for me, is particularly important. It's not that I'm going to say, because it's in the Mahabharata, therefore I now know the last answer, but rather my own reflective processes, just as Socrates does with his the people he's talking with. He's trying to draw out from them their own conclusions and their own realizations without imposing those realizations upon them in a manner that isn't properly understood. And I think it's what the Socratic method means, is to not just to learn something in a rote fashion, but to internalize the teaching and make it a part of your identity. It becomes a part of your person. And I think, and perhaps I'm idealizing here, I think that's the way that the Mahabharata functions. If it functions as an authority text, it doesn't function at all because of its diversity and lack of conclusiveness. But as a sort of inspirational resource for a person who is pursuing ethical, spiritual, devotional considerations, then it functions very well. You can use it, you can take which portions work for you, and then move on and leave behind those that don't. And I think we can see this as well in even in the Bhagavad Gita, which tends to be perhaps more didactic than most passages. But even there, I was looking on some Islamic website, and we said an Islamic critique of the Bhagavad Gita, and which I thought that looks interesting, so I logged onto that. And one of the criticisms they had was that Krishna says, on a number of occasions, iti me mutihi, which means that's my opinion. And the criticism was, how can he be God? If he's God, he doesn't say this is my opinion. God says this is what you should do. And he objected to the fact that God, the supreme absolute deity, should say this is my opinion. But that's what Krishna does repeatedly. And right at the very end, one of the verses I like particularly in the Bhagavad Gita, the only verse I probably follow, but Krishna says, iti te jnanam akhyatam guhyat guhyatam mammaya. Now the most secret, the most mysterious, guhyat guhyatamam jnanam, wisdom, has been revealed by me to you. He says, vimrushaitad asheshena. Vimrusha means to, I think, contemplate, cogitate, think about it. Asheshena, without any gaps in it. Think about everything that I've said. Vimrushaitad asheshena. And then, Yata ichchasi tatakuru. Yata ichchasi means as you like. Tatakuru means so do. In other words, do as you like, basically. Think about it very carefully, and then you must do what you like. And as I say, that's one injunction of the Bhagavad Gita that I follow very devoutly. Apologies. But again, Krishna isn't being dogmatic. He isn't saying, do what I've said now or you're going to get it, or I've got some really bad hells where I can do horrible things to you with hot rods and stuff like that. He's not saying that at all. He's giving Arjuna advice. He's, in a sense, although he's the deity, he is acting as the servant of Arjuna. He is providing Arjuna with the resources that he needs for the spiritual, ethical awakening that he requires at that particular moment. And in a sense, I think that gives us a different model of the way that sacred text works, and perhaps a different model of the way preaching works. And for me, it's something that's very important from my own position and work within the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies. And I'll say a little bit more about it perhaps to conclude in a minute. But I think we can take this idea perhaps beyond the Mahabharata and look at the role that scripture plays in religious life. Not so much as a dogmatic master, but as a servant which provides us with resources in our own personal, intellectual, moral, spiritual development. And I think this isn't just something that I've made up. It's something that I've encountered repeatedly in working with the Hindu community in Britain. You know, one of the things that we've done, as Shanat was mentioning, we have courses on the Upanishads and Vedas, we have courses on Mahabharata and Ramayana, courses on Shankaracharya, etc. But the scriptural courses in particular, when we look at them, the response I get from the Hindu community who are studying with us is completely fascinating. We did one course on ethics and lifestyle, and for that course I produced a number of different quotes from the Manusmriti, which I think perhaps is the main scriptural text, if that's not the wrong word, on those particular issues. And we were reading there things like a woman must treat her husband as a god, even though he's unfaithful, corrupt, ugly, etc. And I could hear the giggles coming up from the women. They were just laughing at that. And then there's things like women must marry at the age, girls must marry at 13, she should be the servant of her father, then she should be protected by her husband, then sometimes she should never be independent. And so we read the passages out, and then we had a discussion on it, and one of the women said, this is my dentist actually, very nice, very devout Hindu lady, gives me free dental treatment. But she said, this is a really evil book, she said. And then her friend Chandrika sitting next to her said, nah, it's just written by some bloke who's having trouble with his wife, she said. Yeah. I said, well, hang on, this is your scripture, and these aren't, you know, apostates or anybody like that. These are very devout, religious-minded individuals who come every week to study Upanishads, etc. And Chandrika, she's got her sons to buy her a complete edition of the Upanishads, and she spent months and months going through. These aren't people who want to get out of Hinduism. These are people who are utterly committed to the tradition, but that's their attitude. Even when we went on to the Ramayana, my dentist again, she stood up and said, this is a terrible thing that Ram has done. He should never have treated Sita in that way, and I know that thousands of Hindu women over the years have suffered because of Ram's treatment of Sita. And I said, well, you're a Ram bhakta. She said, yes, I know, but that doesn't mean I can't not say anything against him. He's done wrong there in treating Sita in that way. And I thought, no, I was very struck by the attitude towards sacred texts that emerged from within the community. We had Yashvant in Leicester went on Kumbh Mela, and we were reading in the text when he came back, anybody who bathes in the Ganga has all his sins removed. So I said to him, here's Yashvant, he's just come back from bathing in the confluence. Anybody think he's sinless now? And they're like, nah. I know him. You know? And they said, well, he's bathed in the Ganga. He said, yeah, but it can't be just that, just some ritual. You've got to have a change in heart as well. But it's there in the text. Yeah, that doesn't matter. So the attitude of freedom to interact with the text isn't just something that I've just made up this morning when I was thinking what to say. It's something that I think is current and active within the community that owns, reveres these sacred texts. That's the way they use that text. And I think that's very often misunderstood from a Western perspective. I've just been marking essays, actually, from the university about women and Hinduism. And it's just constantly, Manusmriti says this, Manusmriti says that. My wrist's aching and said, this doesn't matter. Because nobody reads Manusmriti. Nobody's heard it. Nobody's ever seen it. They don't know. It doesn't mean anything. It's just some old book that people, that Western academics drag up when they want to write an easy text on Hindu ethics. But it doesn't have any relevance at all. And even when Hindus do find it, they just think it's a joke, basically. It's not a binding, authoritative text. And I think that's largely misunderstood. And perhaps if we then look ahead, you know, move on from that and consider, I don't know if this is, Sean, you have to stop me if I step out of line here. But anyway, I'm speaking personally. This is my own view, what I'm doing within the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies, because it's a paradoxical organisation in many ways, because it is legitimately a centre for Hindu studies. And it although many, perhaps a majority of the members are from Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, it is able effectively not to present Hinduism or its teachings from a Gaudiya Vaishnava perspective. So we teach Shankaracharya, Advaita Vedanta alongside Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Vallabhacharya, Chaitanya, etc. And there is no privileging of the Vaishnava traditions within there. And from my perspective, when I go out there, I think, is it therefore a preaching organisation? Or is it just, I don't know, providing jobs for the boys or something like that? Or something to do in our spare time? But I think if you take it from the perspective I've been talking about, looking at the Mahabharata, then it, and again I'm speaking personally, Chant may disagree with me utterly, then it is a preaching organisation, and the influence that we have isn't just providing the Hindu community in Britain with access to their own tradition. It's not just breaking the imperialist stranglehold on Hindu studies. But it's also providing resources for individual people who want to pursue their own spirituality. We're not telling anybody what they should believe. We're not telling anybody how they should live their lives. What we are doing, though, perhaps after the manner of the Mahabharata, is we're coming forward to people and we're saying, this is what this says. Then there's this is what that says. You want to find out something about Krishna, then I'll show you the Krishna katha. If you want to know about Shiva, for those of you who are drawn towards Shaivism, then this is what we have to offer. We don't judge. We sometimes get asked questions. What do you believe? Or because when you're up at the front, people always want to say, what do you believe about this? What do you know? And I never answer, because what does it matter what I believe? I'm just some bloke from Birmingham. You know, there's all sorts of stuff. It doesn't matter what I believe. It's not my function to say what I believe. It's not about me. It's about the resources that I've got access to in the office in Oxford that we can give to people. And we've had people almost humbling afterwards come up to you and say, your course has changed my life. I've had people actually say that. The woman who lost her son in a road accident came up to us and she said, I could never have got through that without attending the courses. And I feel it's a bit strange, because one doesn't feel capable of having that influence, and yet it becomes personal. But it's not about the person who's doing the teaching, it's about the material that we're presenting and making available to the people. So perhaps this is an alternative model of what preaching can be. It's not that you come along to people and you tell them what they should do. You should live like this, that and the other. Or that you should believe that this is the truth about God, this is the truth about the afterlife. Rather, the preaching takes the form of, just as the Mahabharata does in my view, showing you the different options that are possible, available. This is what it says here, this is what it says there. This is what it says there. And then you conclude with Krishna's words, think about everything I've shown you very carefully, and then ultimately go away and do what you think is best to do. And I think this is a very, I don't know where you would locate, but it's a very different form of preaching, but I would say it's nonetheless, it is preaching. And my feeling is that when we are doing courses of that nature, although they're proper academic courses, properly validated by the British academic establishment, they are still a form of preaching to people, and people appreciate that and they see it partially in that way as well. Okay, I think I've said all that I want to say now. So we've got a few minutes left before. I think a couple of points there. I'm not sure I can answer all of that question, because I honestly don't know. But I think Indian consciousness is far more comfortable with what we will perceive as contradiction than we are. We tend to see logical dissonance, and that's an overriding problem. But I think somehow in India people have the ability to believe apparently contradictory things at the same time without it being particularly troubling. If you go back to what the authors of the Mahabharata are trying to do. I think if we isolate that down to the final construction of the narrative, I think they, and I've written on this as well as Jim Fitzgerald, but I think they were reflecting on problems of kingship and ethics at a particular juncture in Indian history. But I think, and I'll maybe broaden out that, that in the period from around 400 to 1000 BC, 400 to the year zero, Indian kingship had taken a movement towards non-violence and an ethical standpoint. In particular here we'll note the historical example of the Emperor Ashok, and we know about him a lot because he left engravings, carvings of his ideas all over India. I had written an article about this a number of years ago actually, in which I've looked at Ashok and then looked at Yudhishthira as well, and I think the authors of the Mahabharata were aware of Ashoka and they admired him, and they almost portrayed Yudhishthira, or they used Yudhishthira to look at those debates, and I think they're aware of both sides of the debate. I don't agree with Jim Fitzgerald that they're saying that Yudhishthira has got it completely wrong. There's clearly a high degree of admiration for his moral standing, but at the same time I think they want to point out that this isn't as simple as it looks at first grasp, that if the king does adopt virtue, then it's going to be problematic. The virtuous king is going to face problems, and it doesn't seek to resolve them. So, what was the other question you're asking?
Well, do you think the authors thought there was an ultimate essence, or is it just the discourse of the time?
I think what we've got to look at more likely is not an author but a redactor, an editor, a person, and you can at times, if you read it very carefully, you can see his hand at work, you can see he's selected certain passages and he's put them at certain places within it. Now whether he counts as an author, I personally I don't know if that's true, but what he has done is, and I think, come back to that question, he has not judged on the particular validity or otherwise of the pieces he's chosen to include. So in that sense, he as an editor rather than an author has been quite happy to select pieces from contrary perspectives and combine them together in one single text. So in that sense, I think he's done that deliberately. I think each individual section is probably composed by a different author, and it comes from some external source. That the final editor or redactor of the Mahabharata has made a selection of pieces from different perspectives and put them together. I think probably the example would be almost as a conference. You know, we have a conference on a particular theme. We might have a conference on dharma, and we'll have different speakers come. And some of the speakers will express radically different views. It's quite an uncomfortable experience happening when you hear the previous paper, and you know that when you're going to speak next, you're going to say something that completely criticises everything that the person has just said, who's now sitting on the front row. You remember that, Chris Nixon? Remember the paper I gave at SOAS about John Brockington? He said to me afterwards, so I'm comfortably sitting on the front row, but listening to what you're saying.
And smiling.
And smiling, yes, very good natured about it, actually. But no, I think that's what it's like. It's like a conference on a particular theme, and there's particular voices that come forward. Some more prominent than others. Maybe the Gita's a keynote speaker on dharma and moksha. But not unless there's other voices as well. The Sulabha, she's got a different, her paper puts forward a different perspective. And at the end, the listeners, the people who are attending the conference, they hear these different voices and they take away the benefit. But there's no sort of conclusion which says this was right and the other was wrong. It's contributions to a central theme. I think it works in that way. And I think the editor, rather than the author of the Mahabharata, did do that deliberately. He wanted to show different perspectives, different opinions on it.
Thank you very much for a very enlightening presentation. I'd like to better understand this concept of servant and master as applied to Shastra that you spoke of.
Sorry, could you say that again? Mark got very bad hearing, I'm afraid.
I'd like to better understand this two aspects of Shastra that you spoke of, the servant and master. In this one we look at Shastra as an authority. One of the three authorities will be checking the three checking systems, Shastra, and Shastra. So it's considered one of the authorities. But at the same time, could you speak on this point of when we look at the Vedas and the Upanishads, could they be considered the master and the Itihasas considered as the servant?
Yes and no. You say in ISKCON that you regard Shastra as absolute authority, but not the Upanishads, the main authority in ISKCON, presumably the Bhagavad. I think in any case the Upanishads work in a similar sort of way, actually. They are non-dogmatic treatises. They are in many ways meditations that are given to individuals, and that's reflected in the fact that you've got innumerable commentaries on the same Upanishad. You've got Shankara's commentary, and you've also got Madhva's commentary on the same Upanishads, drawing radically different conclusions from them. If you look at, for example, the Kena Upanishad, which is one of my favourites for the similar sort of reasons, the Kena Upanishad starts with the word Kena. It's a question: by what is this world sustained? It's a disciple approaching a guru. I think this is really interesting, how the guru responds. The disciple comes forward, and I think it's one of those situations where he claims, I've studied all the Vedas, I know every ritual, etc., but now I just want to learn the last lesson, teach me about Brahman. And the guru replies to him, there are no thoughts that can conceive of it, there are no words that can describe it, therefore I have nothing to say on that subject, you must go away and realise it. And he advises him, he says, what you're looking for is jnana, but what you need is pratibuddha jnana, awakened jnana, and that can't be spoken to you. So in a sense he's making the same point in the Upanishads, that this isn't a truth that can be encapsulated in simplistic creeds or formulae, which is what you're asking for as a disciple. He says, what you've got to do is go away and transform yourself into the type of person in whom that pratibodha jnana will awaken. It's not a matter of reading the Upanishad. I said to the students at the beginning, jnana is the key to the Upanishads, but don't think at the end of this course you're going to walk away enlightened beings giving moksha. We'd charge a lot more if that was the case for the courses. But it's not like that. That's intellectual. It's intellectual knowledge. In the Upanishad is quite overt about that, but it still requires awakened knowledge, jnana and pratibodha jnana. Same in Shaivism, the Shaiva Siddhanta. There's the Shiva Jnana Bodham of Nikanda Shivam. Same point is made. There is knowledge, which is the knowledge that we get from listening and reading, then the Shiva Jnana. So the Shiva Jnana Bodham is the awakening of Shiva knowledge, which is a different order of knowledge. I think that's what the Upanishad as well is pushing towards. If you're looking to get absolute definitive answers from the Upanishads, I think you'll be struggling again, as evidenced by the commentaries. Come back to the point about ISKCON. Again, I'm not qualified to comment. I've absolutely no objection to people believing in the Bhagavad word for word. And in our classes, as well as those who dispute scriptures, there are individuals who stand up and say, no, every word of the Ramayana is absolute truth. Hanuman did grasp the sun, and things like that. He did fly through a big demon's mouth. I believe that absolutely. Others will say, no, I don't. I think that's a matter of personal faith, but I think it can be problematic, and it can be problematic problematic within the context of ISKCON. You know, from my own experience, going back right to the early days when the fifth canto was published, came out, it caused a real ripple, and a lot of people were deeply troubled by the having to believe in a model of the universe that seemed so incongruous with what seemed to be apparent and what the scientific explanation was. So if it worked, if scripture functions for an individual on that way as absolute authority, then that's part of the same process I'm talking about. They've selected scripture and they're using that resource in that particular manner as the absolute truth and absolute guide, and that's one way of selecting the resource, that's one way of using the resource. And as long as it's not problematic, then that's fine. But then another person might use the same resource in a very different way, where he or she doesn't choose to believe every last word, but it finds an inner truth within there that transcends the literal truth of the passages that appear to be mythological. So I would say in the model I've sketched, both options are open to individuals.
And so could there, you know, be possibly the absolute truth in scripture, and then it's just a question of one shraddha, whether how much of that is revealed.
I don't feel qualified really to really answer that.
You know, if scripture is an answer, it's just a question of how shraddha is revealed.
Possibly so. But I mean, again, it's an individual decision. One person might feel that, another person might not feel that, and I think that what I'm suggesting is broadening out the approach to scripture, that there isn't only one way to use that resource as your absolute authority in which you have complete faith. There are other ways of using the same resource as a source of awakening and inspiration, even where the literal truth is not accepted.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I really enjoyed your presentation of Mahabharata's way of teaching, not as a master, but rather maybe as an observer. But I'm just wondering how representative is your understanding in relation to sort of general Hindu perspective on scripture. I mean, somewhat related to her question, especially given that there is sort of strong Mimamsaka sort of trend where the Vidhinisheda injunction prohibition is very strong, and in Bhakti context also yesterday Gopinathacharya's presentation was having faith in scripture in the Hindu context doesn't mean accepting dogmas, because the scripture teaches you how to act. And in that context, the Vidhinisheda is again very strict. I mean, in ISKCON context, for example, it's not that, well, we recommend to you you chanting 16 rounds, but it's up to you to choose. It's not like that. It's 16 rounds, and that's it, final word. So I was just curious that how do you see this Mimamsa sort of trend?
A couple of points there, and I might forget the second one. So anyway, remind me if I have it. The first point I would say is about accepting authority in a modern context. I think it's Peter Berger, who a number of years ago wrote a book called The Heretical Imperative, and complex title. What he means basically, in the context of modernity, there are no orthodox people. Everybody is a heretic. Because if you choose to follow the direction, you've ultimately, at the beginning point is you made that choice. You examined the evidence yourself, you looked at the teaching, you looked at the teacher, you looked at the text, and you thought, yes, I will follow that path. So although you're following an authority, you've chosen to accept that authority. In a sense, that's where I was going back. The other question is that you've selected to use the resources available to you in the way that you think will be most effective, but in your particular case. Second, the point about going back to and to say the same about, well, all the orthodox traditions as well, the Vedanta, even the Sankhya and the Yoga, they all make a point that the pramans, the highest praman is Shabda, praman, the word of the scripture. And theoretically that's the truth, that the scripture is established as the absolute authority. So I make two points on that. First of all, if you look at the actual commentaries on the scripture, you get the impression that despite the statement that I accept the Veda as absolute authority, the commentators at different points, they don't function in that way. And when Shankara comes to a passage of the Isha Upanishad, which doesn't fit in with the way he's interpreting it, he just changes it. He says, this word must, I can't remember the exact verse. Maybe remember, you know, because you teach it more than me. There's a case, isn't there, where he just changes the whole word. Even a Madhvacharya, you know, he changed, when he comes to Tattvamasi in the Chandogya, I am Atma Tattvamasi, he stretches out the last day of Atma, just make it I am Atma Atattvamasi. So instead of that is what you are, it becomes that is what you're not. Now he might believe that he is therefore giving a true rendition of what the Upanishad is teaching, but one suspects that he is primarily concerned to demonstrate the fact that his own realization, his own truth, is in accordance with the teaching of scripture. And where it comes to be a conflict between the two, it's the scripture that is transformed rather than his own doctrine. And that's a little controversial to say that, but one gets that impression from reading the commentaries. Secondly, I think there's a difference between the theologians of the tradition and the lived tradition itself. So although the theologians of the tradition do make that point that absolute authority is derived from the Veda or Prasthantroya in the case of Vedanta, the living tradition, the community of believers, don't regard it in that sense at all. They don't feel bound. The locus of authority, if you like, in the Hindu community doesn't rest in sacred text. It primarily rests within family and community. So I think there's a distance between the theologians of the tradition, the way they give credit to the absolute authority of the Vedas, and the way that the mass of the community function in their religious life. Is that, are we off?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We have 10 bells. Well, okay, one more question. No. Yeah, there's 11 more questions. And then we'll have 3 hours for lunch, so you can ask me hundreds of questions.
Just in kind of support of your perspective from another angle, I mean, I'm sure you reflect on this as well, but I think the Ramayana is another good example. You know, the text is complex and has multiple points of view. The fact that the extent to which it's teaching is didactic is through examples.
Exactly.
And multiple examples. Yeah. Sometimes competing points of view. But what I've been fascinated by with the Ramayana is the way in which different groups historically have selectively appropriated sections of the text to legitimate or to support their competing perspective. So, say, in the medieval period, you have a variety of different rajas who would appropriate the text and use it to legitimate a particular rule in a particular region. But then, in more recent times, you have an outcast group in Madhya Pradesh, where people are thinking of a group called the Ramnamis. That you know, this is their text, and they recite it daily, and they spread the name of Ram all over their bodies. I mean, this is, but the text itself, they recite, but they selectively recite. You know, so they'll take the narrative about Shabari, the outcast ascetic woman, that Ram is accept a piece of fruit that she's bitten at.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, look at what Ram did with this outcast ascetic woman. Look at the hugs. This monkey, and you know, so on one level, they will ignore the sections of the text that deal with Ram and in his dharma moment when he's upholding the rules of purity and impurity and performing all the rituals. They don't look at those parts of the text. They recite those parts of the text that are in harmony with their particular perspective. And then you have other groups like the ascetic group named important ascetic group, the Ramanandi. That also use the text. And again, they recite the text and see Ram is an ascetic.
Yeah.
He may be a married ascetic, but so they produce those sections of the text that deal with Ram as a kind of domesticated ascetic mode when you're coming through the forest. So, you know, I mean, my experience, I've done a lot of thinking about scripture and your whole notion. And scripture, it's a relational category. I mean, if one thinks about it in relation to religious communities, not from a kind of text-critical perspective. The scripture is a category that's always in relationship to a religious community or whom it is sacred and authoritative. But the same text can be appropriated and authoritative for varieties of communities, and those same communities can take up the same text and use it in completely different ways. But I think in Hindu context, there's never been a problem with that. I mean, the idea that the text can serve different purposes and for different groups.
I agree. I mean, it's exactly the same point, isn't it? You can see that different communities who have different religious needs are using the same text as their resource and employing it in that way. I mean, it's fascinating what you're saying, and also the way that the Ramcharitamanas has almost been created to fill a void because the Ramayana isn't sufficiently devotional. So therefore, you invent a new Ramayana as your devotional resource. But again, absolutely, it exemplifies the point, doesn't it? That within India, people will use the text as their source of inspiration. And also the fact that that doesn't mean that they don't revere the text. Just the opposite, you know. So they absolutely, you know, when it's on television, it's just everything closes down. And I've seen, plays where I've seen a couple of old ladies get up on stage to attack Ravan when he comes out because they're so engrossed in the drama. So there's a really, really... So I don't think the fact that I'm saying means that it's sort of a modernist rejection of scripture, the validity of scripture. It's just that there's a deep and profound reverence for the scripture, the text, but it's just using it perhaps in a slightly...
Using it as a resource, exactly.
Exactly, yeah.
What is the part of the scripture that speaks most?
Exactly,
because
yeah.
Limiting that is the part they privilege, and maybe they ignore the parts that are a little less in harmony with their particular perspective.
Because you can't read
but
everything.
It doesn't seem to be a problem historically with the variety of communities that have used these.
No, not at all. Just for us. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Yep, I'm done.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.